We acknowledge the traditional owners and custodians of the land on which company has been recorded, the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation. We respect their continuing culture and the past and present contributions they have made to this region. You're listening to Company, the podcast connecting Australian artists, where we talk all things personal, professional, and spiritual. Joining you, as always, are your hosts, Georgia Kennedy and Tiana Catalano. Hello, and welcome to our second episode of Company. We've been absolutely stoked with what you've all had to say about our first episode, and we're really keen to share some more with you. So today, we're very excited to share our conversation with Sean Rennie.
Yes, so we actually had Sean with us in Perth just before COVID happened, and we were doing Mamma Mia,
and Tiana was Donna.
Yes, yes, that old chestnut. But we spent heaps of time with Sean, and unfortunately, because of the timing of COVID, we had to stop our rehearsals when we were about to go into production week, and we never got to perform the show.
Yeah.
So that was a bit devastating, but we're all in it together, so it was all fine. And I would never forget, there was the last rehearsal we had, and that's when the 1.5-meter rule had come in. So Sean was trying to create a Mamma Mia where we all touched our own chairs and we spaced them around the stage, and we were all 1.5 meters from each other, and only half of the class could actually dance on stage at a time. The rest of us had to stagger on the stairs, and it was just a time. And he was such a trooper. It was so funny in the end to look back. But he has been such an amazing support for us for this podcast.
Yeah.
And has, you know, gone above and beyond to help us get in contact with people. And he's just the kindest, most generous person ever. And this conversation was awesome. We talk about him as a performer and then going into directing and kind of how his personal life has shaped his career as well. And yeah, it's really, really lovely conversation. We're really keen for you guys to hear it.
Yeah, he's beautiful. And one thing I love about him as a director as well is I feel very comfortable to fail around him. Like, I feel like I can fuck up and do stuff wrong and he will still accept me, and there's no pressure to be great with him. There's just a freedom to be vulnerable on stage and tell the story.
Yeah.
So I love him.
Amazing person. But before we do that, what time is it, Georgia?
It's time for Riff of the Week.
Woo!
When have you ready?
Okay.
Riff of the Week. Riff of the Week.
So my Riff of the Week is Brené Brown, her podcast. I love it. But in particular, this week I listened to her interview with Laverne Cox, who is a lovely African-American transgender woman. She is in Orange Is the New Black. That's where I've seen her. And they just talk about the Black Lives Matter movement, and they talk about Laverne's new documentary that's come out called Disclosure, which is about being transgender in America. I have yet to watch it, but it is first on my list. I'm really excited to look at it. But I just think if you're looking for a podcast where we hear Black voices talking about the movement, that is a great one. And I love Brené's conversations with everyone, but in particular, I really enjoyed this one with Laverne Cox. So that's my Riff of the Week, Tiana. What about you?
Okay, so my Riff of the Week is actually about the Netflix content that is coming out for the Black Lives Matter. And fun fact, if you are not sure what to watch, because I know people are reposting lists on Instagram, if you actually go onto Netflix and type into the search bar Black Lives Matter, all of the content that is related to that or about people of color, like movies or TV shows, it's all on there. So easy to find.
That's so good.
First of all, my first point. Second point, I watched 13th. When was it? A couple of nights ago. And oh my gosh, I could say so much, but there's one thing that I really want to talk about. And I watched the interview with Oprah and the director, Ava DuVernay. I hope I said that right. But in the interview, she talked about the kind of structure of the documentary and her belief that we absolutely need to learn about our past to be able to move forward. And it kind of stuck with me because in one part of the documentary, there is some footage from, I think it's the 1950s, of this group of white men beating a black man walking through the streets for no apparent reason. Then she switches to some footage of a Trump election and a rally. And there's footage today of white people hitting a woman of color in a crowd and forcing her to get out of that room when she's trying to speak up for herself. And it was just such a thing of, if we don't learn about our past and acknowledge what the past is, then you cannot see that we are not moving forward now. And that is the biggest thing that I have about in Australia, because I have done 2 years of a teaching degree. I didn't finish it, but I did my Indigenous studies, and that was the first time I actually learned about the history of Australia, like the real history of Australia and what actually happened in the settlement and all that kind of stuff. And I think if the Australian curriculum will not change and actually teach the proper history of our country, then we will never be able to move forward. And I just think it was just a really eye-opening moment of like, 100% we need to, you know, have this happen in America, in Australia, whatever. And I'm just really passionate about that because I want to be a teacher, but I will not teach in the Australian curriculum the way it is set out now when it's tailored to white, you know, kids who have grown up in families that, you know, can speak English fluently, like, you know, and that's a whole topic in itself. But easy to get onto the Netflix content, do it. The documentary is so well done, I can't even. And yeah, it's just a really good eye-opener. So that's my riff. That was a bit of a long riff. Sorry about it. Sean is an award-winning NIDA and RADA graduate director who has worked across Australian premieres of new works to innovative revivals of treasured musicals. Sean has received 3 Sydney Theatre Award nominations for Best Director and won the Broadway World Award for Best Direction of a Musical for his 2016 production of Rent at the Hayes Theatre.
This year has already seen Sean direct Irene, neglected musicals, The Rise and Disguise of Elizabeth R, Hayes Theatre, Considering Matthew Shepard, Sydney Philharmonia Choir, and Mamma Mia at WAPA.
He also assistant directed on the London production of A Christmas Carol and Once We Lived Here, where he was resident director.
Sean also co-created Light the Night, an annual benefit concert for leukemia research, which he produced and directed for 10 years.
So welcome to Sean Rennie. Thank you for coming to Company today.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
So how are you going? How's life in COVID treating you?
It's all settled into a new norm now. For most of us, I think we all feel the same thing. It's been good. I feel we've been pretty lucky. My husband Ben and I are pretty lucky in the sense that, you know, we don't have kids that we have to homeschool, and, you know, we don't have a mortgage that we were worried about paying, or so we could just sort of bunker down in our little apartment here in Sydney and survive. So as long as we kept sort of being able to pay our rent and have food on the table, we were fine. Obviously, both of our work got wiped for the year. But all in all, I think like everyone in the world has gone through different stages of grief and acceptance and embracing it in some ways. I've been cooking more and buying houseplants. I've bought so many houseplants.
I've seen. They're beautiful.
Oh, thanks. It's sort of, I guess, I think a lot of people have experienced this. It's sort of the slowing down, that forced slowing down has been really good at sort of just wanting to fill that stuff up with getting back to basics, like providing food for your loved ones and nurturing and growing things and that type of element of life. Mm-hmm. And it's been really good to sort of have the time and the space to sort of be able to tune in with that. And then the sort of work, the balance between, I think in the industry, we're so good at hustling all the time that, you know, it took me a while to sort of figure out that hustle energy was sort of a bit redundant, and I had to sort of be okay with not doing much. And that's been sort of a really good thing for me to remember, because after years of just hustling, you sort of like, you know, you can get a bit on the guinea pig wheel. So it was nice to get off the guinea pig wheel for a second.
Yeah, absolutely. And is there anything that you're watching at the moment? Any arts recommendations that you have for us that are getting you through this time?
I binged watched all of Breaking Bad for the first time.
Oh, okay.
So it's not very arts related. I mean, it's amazing TV.
No, it's amazing.
So actually one thing I have done is I've signed up to do a online directing for film course, and just sort of trying to use the time that I've got to sort of diversify and learn some new things. And so I have been sort of engaging with film and TV in a new way, which is cool. And so and I've also been doing the National Theatre, National Theatre Live. I've been watching each of those each week. Mm. You know, Streetcar Named Desire this week, and Jane Eyre and Frankenstein. But yeah, there's been so much content that it's been a bit overwhelming at times. And I think I struggled personally with, you know, so many people sort of rushing to put stuff up online, which is fantastic, and then sort of trying to figure out what I should be doing in this time, and going back to that sense of like, I need to hustle.
Mm.
And as a director, it's a strange thing because, you know, I sort of see my job as essentially holding space for a whole lot of other artists to do their best work. You know, I don't personally create anything myself. I don't, you know, build sets or design sets or act scenes or do monologues. Or what the job of a director is to hold space where other people can feel safe to take risks and to do the things that they're good at. So I've been sort of struggling with, well, who am I if I'm not in a room with people? You know, if I'm not leading a group of people, who am I? You know, what do I do? And so I think that's partly why I've been drawn to sort of looking at film and TV in this time, just as a way of learning a new language, because it is a totally different language, and just sort of using the space to sort of think about what the next 10, 15 years might look like, and all those things that we're all doing.
Well, we have a couple of fun questions to get us rolling. The first one is, what is a theatre experience that really changed or moved you?
Ooh. The very first thing I remember seeing was Hot Shoe Shuffle when I was about 10 or 11 with my parents and my grandparents, and it changed and moved me in the sense that it was the day that I recognized that, oh, those people get to do that every night and they get paid for it and that's their job. And that was a groundbreaking realization for me, because I remember saying to mum and dad, that's what I want to do, you know. So that was in, I can't remember, 1994 or something, Hot Shoe Shuffle. It starred Rhonda Birchmore, and then ironically or amazingly, years later, when I did my first professional show, I was playing Pepper in Mamma Mia opposite Rhonda Birchmore. So there was this lovely, like, full circle thing. When I finally got my first professional job, it was with someone that I'd seen on stage when I realized that that's what I wanted to do with my life. So that was
incredible.
Very sort of, serendipitous. And then another piece of theatre that really stayed in my guts was two things. A production of Into the Woods, which I saw in New York in 2014 by Fiasco Theatre Company. Into the Woods is sort of my favourite musical and a show that I won't die a happy man unless I've directed a production of Into the Woods. I just love it for so many reasons, especially now. And that show just gets me inside of me. And then another piece of theatre that really changed and inspired me was Ivor Van Hove's A View from the Bridge when I was in London, living in London. And it was this incredible production of Arthur Miller's A View from the Bridge, which was simplified, stripped back with set, no set, and but just tragic in its scope and its scale.
Yeah, amazing.
And then I guess as a director or a performer, what's been the funniest or a biggest mishap that's happened, and how have you dealt with it?
Oh, goodness. The first thing that comes to mind is during previews of Only Heaven Knows with Hayden T. So I directed a revival of Only Heaven Knows, which is an Australian musical, at the Hayes in 2016, I think. And during previews, Hayden had to, in one particular scene, had to wear this toupee. And I was watching the show, and in Act One, he came on, did this scene, and then halfway through the scene, it sort of looked like he had a stroke, like he sort of like flinched and swatted in himself quite vigorously. And I was like, what the hell did Hayden just do? And then the scene went on, and, you know, and then at interval or after the show, I went backstage and I was like, Hayden, what happened in that scene? And he said that a cockroach had crawled out from underneath his wig and down his face.
No.
And the other actors on stage saw it, and I hadn't seen it from the audience, but that's one, the first thing that comes to mind. But then there's obviously there's lots and lots and lots of things over the years, but that's
yeah.
One.
Oh, I love live theatre. That's great.
Can't beat it.
Rough.
Amazing. So you started off as a performer and then you got into directing. I was just wondering, could you tell us a bit about that? How did that come about for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yes, I started off as a little boy doing dancing classes and song and dances and, you know, came up through the school system doing the school spectacular and talent development project. Did the NIDA musical theatre course, and then quite quickly after that got into Mamma Mia, as I discussed. And so very fortunately and lucky for me, I from a very early age, I was sort of in touring around doing shows. And so I did that for 15 years. And that was like a combination of being in a show for a chunk of time and then being unemployed for a chunk of time and spending all the savings and then being in a show for a while and then spending all the savings. So that, and as we all know, my day job in between, and so shows I did as a performer were Mamma Mia and Fiddler on the Roof and the music of Angelo Weber, and I did Cats for a long time and lots of sort of smaller independent shows in between and all around that. And then my day job, for part of that in between performing gigs was me working as a lighting technician on the big budget show. Pardon me. So I would be, you know, on stage doing Cats 1 week and then the show would close. And then I got a job as a lighting technician on West Side Story, which started in the same theater the next week. And so that, started off as a bit of a joke. My best friend on the Cats tour was the head electrician, and he just sort of got me in because he needed an extra set of hands, essentially. And so that started off as a bit of a joke, but it ended up being the way that I would earn money when I wasn't on tour. And so that combination of being knowing what it felt like to be on stage and to arrive at stage door and at the hour call and getting to make up and warm up and do the show and cool down, like, that experience combined with the experience of arriving to a theater as a technician and sort of doing pre-show checks and watching the artists get ready, and the way that some artists treated me differently because I was wearing blacks compared to when I was on stage, you know, the different sort of that experience was really valuable. And also being able to just observe, you know, the art form from within it as a cast member and experience that experience, but also as a lighting technician, being able to observe it from a two-dimensional point of view, from a follow spot operator, for example, and be able to watch it night by night and examine it and see the storytelling through shapes. That was really very intriguing to me and very useful now as a director. My transition really sort of started to happen when I was doing Fiddler on the Roof. My younger brother, Matthew, was diagnosed with leukemia, and he was sick for 4 years. And I was sitting around the hospital feeling useless and, you know, being there for my brother as he was going through all of his treatment, and just feeling so redundant and needing to put that energy into something. And so with some family friends, we started this event called Light the Night that was an annual fundraising event to raise money for leukemia research. And so I was doing Fiddle on the Roof, and it started off as literally just an idea of, hey, what can I do? I've got all these friends during a show. We can put on a concert and raise some money, essentially, which, you know, we all know that feeling. And it went very well that first year. And Matthew was there for that first year. He was there for the second year. And then he passed away just like, I think it was 3 weeks before the third event. And so that third event, in 2007 became sort of like a large extended memorial / event for my brother. And that event sort of really solidified the event in sort of the calendar of Sydney. And so we ran the event for 10 years as a fundraising event for leukemia research. And it just kept growing and growing. And it was something that I would like go away on tour, and then I'd come back to Sydney and pull together this concert every year. And it was during that time that I started to realize, oh, this is my favorite day of the year. I think I have some skills in this, in the sense of like being able to pull people together and manage the running of the day, and using my mates and skills as a lighting technician, as well as my understanding of what it's like to be on stage singing. And so I started to realize during this event over 10 years that I think I might want to one day move into being a director as a profession whenever I'm ready to stop performing. But that event obviously became, it's the thing that I'm most proud of in my entire life, yeah, because it was something for my family and something that sort of became very, it became larger than my family, and we raised, more than $500,000 for this charity over the 10 years. Oh, and we decided to stop it stop at 10. We did 10 events, annual events. And that was partly because, for a couple of reasons, it had become, my family needed to move on. I think after my brother had passed away 7 years by that stage. And so I think my family needed to move on from it. And then secondly, I also knew that the energy and the time that event was taking on an annual basis was energy that I probably was ready to start putting into my own career, having learnt a lot through those 10 years of developing that concept.
Yeah. Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Mm. When were you sort of ready? What was like the catalyst for being ready to move from a performer to a director? Was it through doing that for your brother?
Yeah.
That you decided that?
It was a slow build. I think it's a tricky thing as a director to, because you have to, as a director, you have to have the confidence to say, I think I know what this needs. You have to have the self-belief to be able to say, I think we should go this way. But at the same time, you also have to have the same amount of humility and sort of modesty to say, well, somebody else might have an idea that might be better, mm-hmm. and be willing to go in that direction. So it was I think it just took me 10 years of doing Light the Night to build up the confidence mm-hmm. to then be able to feel confident to stand in front of a room of actors and actors that I respect and I always think are much more talented than I am or was as a performer, to then sort of have the confidence to say, hey guys, let's go in this direction. Come on this way. And so, whereas with Light the Night, because it was an event that I'd created, and had sort of curated each year, that was the day of the year that I always felt, confident in doing that. And then over the years of when this, it just happens slowly, the thought process starts dropping in. You start to realize that Light the Night is my favorite day of the year because I get to, play this role essentially and do this thing that I think I'm good at. And then you start to go into rehearsals with other on other shows that you're a cast member in, and you know, start to notice things that aren't your jurisdiction. I started to notice lighting that I was like, why is the director letting that happen like that? And why is the director not fixing that? And I just started to feel like I had more to offer, I guess. And eventually it started to become frustrating to the point that I came home one day and my husband said, I came home from a particular rehearsal and was like, oh, frustrated with a particular director. And Ben, my husband, said, Sean, you just need to direct something. Stop coming home and complaining about it and just like put your money where your mouth is, essentially.
Yeah.
Was there a grieving process in a sense from like maybe saying goodbye to being a performer and moving into directing, or was it just so exciting that you never really sort of realized that your dream was changing and evolving?
As I said, it sort of happened slowly. And as it started to happen, I knew that one day I will want to be a director. Like, I think I couldn't see myself as an older actor, but I could see myself as an older director, you know, in my own self-vision. Yeah. And I have to admit, the very first day that I started on Rent, which was the first show I directed, I knew I was like, oh, this is what I was always meant to be doing. Mm-hmm. Like, it just sort of made more sense to me. And I think the reason I say that is, as a performer, I was always quite insecure. I was that voice that I think most performers have, everyone has, of, oh, I'm shit, I can't sing high enough, oh, I'm bad at accents, oh, I'm not flexible as that next person, all those self-doubts. I struggled to silence that when I was performing. And, you know, I know that most performers struggle with that to varying degrees. But when I'm directing, I don't self-critique as much because the energy for me feels outer. It feels sort of like it's a forward energy towards the person that I'm working with. Like I don't judge myself as a director in the same way that I would judge myself as a performer. And I recognize working with great actors now, when I have the opportunity to work with great actors, I recognize that's what makes a great actor as well. They are able to get out of their way more often than not, and their energy is able to be forward and focused on the other person and about affecting change on the other person that they're on stage with. And I think that's when you can sort of spend a whole day in a rehearsal room and you don't feel self-conscious, you don't feel tired or hungry or that you even need to go to the toilet, because the energy, you're just able to sit in this sort of forward momentum. And when I recognized that as a director, I was like, oh, this is, I think, what I'm really meant to be doing. And so it was a slow transition. It sort of happened when I started to direct. I was still occasionally auditioning for things. Yeah. And then eventually I had given myself a mental sort of timeline, I guess. I thought, oh, well, if, you know, I'll give this directing thing 12 months, and if it doesn't lead to another directing gig, right, then I'll, you know, that'll be it.
Yeah.
But then as it turns out, you know, every time it just has always occurred that by the time I finish a project or a show opens as a director, I know what the next project is. And then, and that's sort of rolled on. And as long as that's rolling on, then I don't miss it. I don't miss it. No. Occasionally I miss singing. Occasionally I'm like, oh, that's right, you were a singer. it's sometimes funny when people, like, you know, students like you guys or people that I've met through Whopper as a director, and then they see something of me singing, and it's like it's a different life now, you know, it's sort of like a past life. And I'm sometimes reminded, oh, that's right, you were a singer once upon a time.
So do you think, you say you don't really miss performing, but do you think there could ever be a future where you could be an older actor that, now having had the experience as a director, would go back into it with a different mindset and objectivity, I guess?
Yes, potentially. I think that's the beauty about being an actor, is that your product is ever evolving in terms of acting doesn't go away. You know, there will always be stories to be told, and your product as an actor is is your body and your life experience and your brain. And that changes as you evolve and change. So even though right now I've got not a focus on pursuing that career-wise, that element, it doesn't mean that in 5 years, 10 years, 50 years, that I might not want to. And yes, I think there is a world where potentially you could go back to that. I don't foresee it for myself, but I don't block it out either. And, you know, and the reason I don't block it out is because I've had plenty of actor friends say, that's it, I'm not acting anymore, and then go and do something else for quite a while, and then have a second resurgence in their career because, their facility has become different than what they were offering before, and they've got something else to offer. So, so I think it could potentially be a thing, but hopefully I'll be so busy as a director, I won't have time.
Absolutely.
True.
And when you are so busy as a director, and it is your whole world, what are some things that you do for yourself that keep you grounded that are maybe outside of the arts world?
Well, and I think this is the beauty of COVID, because actually just when I was over in Perth with you folk, somebody said to me, so what do you do, what are your hobbies other than theatre? And I really struggled to answer that question. I was like, oh, I don't know what my hobbies are other than theatre is my entire life and has been for so long. My husband works in theatre, So the wonderful thing about COVID is it has sort of forced me to just, disengage with that for a second. And that's been a, process in itself. But I religiously go for a walk every day, and those walks, I've been doing that for years. And those walks during COVID have just gotten longer and longer and longer. So like at the moment I walk for about, 2.5-3 hours a day. And that is sort of important time for myself. It used to be creatively, I would go for walks, before coming to rehearsals or, whatever it was. Most of my creative thinking happens when I'm walking. But nowadays it's sort of just been time to sort of like process, what's important to me. So walking, I really go for lots of walks. I do meditate. I meditate, try to meditate once a day, just not for long, but just 15 minutes or so.
And when you walk, are you listening to anything like a podcast or music, or is it sort of like a mindfulness meditation as you walk, or is it a mix?
A bit of everything. Especially now the walks are getting longer. I definitely listen to a lot of podcasts. Love podcasts, and they range from the New York Times Daily to Broadway Backstage to funny podcasts. So they'll be whatever, Spirit, like Brené Brown or whatever. If it's in prep for a show, like leading into pre-production for, for Amelie, which was meant to start rehearsals tomorrow, Monday actually, I would have, about 6 months ago, I would have walked a lot with Amelie soundtrack and, French just podcasts around Amelie and sort of just wandered around and sort of been in that world. I think it's something about, and same as long drives, if you have to be in a car and you've got to go for a long drive for a few hours, there's something about the being active physically and mentally alert to alert enough to walk around and not bump into things. But also having the space to allow your brain to wander and allowing certain connections to fall into place that may not, do so if you're distracted by listening to, or watching TV. Walking is, if anything, that's sort of like my most precious thing that I do for myself. I've gotten into cooking, which is I'm a late comer to cooking, and that has been a COVID discovery for me.
Do
Do you feel like you appreciate the food more now that you're the one cooking it as well? You go, oh, this is amazing because I did it.
100%. Well, this is 100%. And the sense of pride that I, when I give it to Ben and I like watch him eat it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how is it? You know,
yeah.
Because, you know, I'm really getting into that. And I it's like simple things. And this is all about COVID and slowing down and having the time to appreciate these things. But I was grating, this sounds so basic and so banal, but I was grating ginger the other day and I was like, my God, that smells amazing. Mm, you know, and it's just, I've never really been one to appreciate that element of cooking. Cooking's always been a perfunctory thing to do just to keep me alive. Whereas now I'm actually enjoying the sensory element of it. And the, you know, realizing that it's about nurturing and, you know, literally feeding the people you love, you know, with something that you've created.
Amazing.
Perfect.
Amazing. I love it. I love it. So we have a couple of concluding questions for you. What would be some advice that you would give to your younger self, having now been through a career as a performer and then going into directing? What would you say to younger Sean?
Yes. I mean, it's a tricky one because I recognize that I'm where I, everything I have today is because of things that have happened in my life that have gotten me to where I am today. So for example, if my brother had never gotten sick, I don't know if I would be a director. You know, it's a very interesting thing to think that nothing is wasted. Me going through periods of being an out of work actor and needing to get a job as a lighting technician at the time was difficult for my ego. It wasn't an easy thing to do because I was on stage one week in, you know, in a lead role in a musical, and then the next day going into the same theater dressed in blacks and having that some members of that company not giving me the ego stroke that I was used to the week before. So that challenge at the time I can see was you know, it was difficult, but now I look back, I think, well, I'm so glad that I did that because nothing is wasted. Everything you go through in your life is of use. Even when I was living in London for a couple of years and working, you know, at a restaurant and working as the host of a restaurant on the door of this very fancy Australian restaurant and telling people they had to queue in the snow for an hour to come inside, that skill set of like being able to read and charm people is a useful skill that I now use, you know, as a director. So nothing is wasted. And so I guess the advice I would give myself though is get amongst it as much as you can without any sense of ego. Like don't let the thought that, oh, that's not a good enough role or that's not a good enough experience or that sense of embarrassment of, oh, I don't want to go and be an usher at that theater because what if people see me as an usher? Mm. None of that in the long term matters. What matters is the experience you get as an usher watching that show 8 shows a week and what you might learn and who you might meet and, you know, all the the advice I'd give to younger people is get amongst it, no matter what that means. If you can get an internship somewhere, great. If you can work for free somewhere, great. If you can usher somewhere, great. If you can, you know, create your own show or create your own podcast, great. Mm-hmm. It's all grist to the mill in terms of building what ends up being your career. And you just don't know what might lead to what and what network might lead to what and what, you know, what friend you meet might not be the next great director or composer or, you know. So that's the one thing I think I was probably a little bit like concerned about what people thought, you know, especially I think having done Mamma Mia early on and being lucky to get into a show when I was still a teenager and then, you know, tour around for 3 years and be in a professional environment early. Mm. I think I then after that had a little bit of, you know, ego and pride about, you know, going back to a normal day job or, you know, And now I recognize that's sort of wasted energy, that sort of energy of worrying about what people might think. People aren't thinking about your career. They're too busy thinking about their own career.
You know? Yeah. Yeah.
So don't worry about what other people are thinking. Just get in there and just get in amongst it as much as you can.
That's great. That's a big lesson to learn.
And I think
letting go of the ego.
Yeah. And I think during COVID, that's kind of been a lesson that everyone's kind of had to take on as well. Like all these other opportunities, whether it's like an online kind of thing that you delve yourself into, it's kind of like opened my eyes to, oh, I could create something actually. Yeah. Because I was forced to and I couldn't just do the stage performing thing that I usually do. But, yeah, I think that's kind of been like a blessing in COVID.
Yeah. And like feeling the fear in doing it anyway. Well, yeah. I listened to Brené Brown's podcast about COVID and her and her team say FFT, like fucking first time. Like this is the fucking first time I'm doing this and I'm frustrated that it's not going to be perfect, but I just got to do it. And the more you do it, the less ego – the more ego shed happens and the less fear that you have.
Mm. Yeah, 100%. And, you know, there is no perfect. Nothing is perfect. That is, and if you are waiting for things to be perfect, then just nothing will ever happen, you know. Mm. And so, but and that sense of don't worry about what other people are thinking, just get in amongst it and try some things. I definitely, all of my friends who have careers that I admire and that you would admire are all people who are out there making it happen themselves. They're all people who are creating things themselves and making opportunities and making work and content. And, you know, no one gets anywhere by just waiting for it to come to you, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's one thing I've learned early on. And, you know, I think younger me was waiting for the perfect opportunity to come along. And that's what I guess my advice would be. Like, don't worry about it. Just get out there and do something. Get in and find the people you admire and reach out to them and do something with them, you know, ask them. Like, the worst they can say is no, they're too busy.
And then what are your hopes and dreams for the Australian arts industry?
I would love to see it alive. I'd love to see it still existing. I think it's a really interesting, scary time for us because we don't know how audiences are going to respond post-COVID and whether or not people are going to be bouncing back to theatre or whether or not it's going to be a slow build. So in 5 years, I would love to see the theatre industry thriving again, because I think we were really vibrant and it was feeling very vibrant. And there are imbalances amongst the system in terms of, you know, it's tricky for freelance artists. It's tricky as an artist in Sydney, especially to earn a living wage. And, you know, there's certainly work to be done between bridging the gap between the commercial sector and the independent sector. So I would love to see when we rebuild a bit more of a flow-on effect between the work that gets done, say, at the Hayes or at the Old Fitz or at the smaller theatres and the work that gets done at the Lyric and the Capitol, and a little bit more of a I think there's scope for work to be done in the gap between the two in Australia, you know, in sort of mid-sized theatres. I would love to see more Australian-led commercial content, meaning, you know, commercial musicals and theatre work that is led by Australian directors and choreographers and writers and designers. Not to say that, you know, the Hamiltons and the Moulin Rouges of the world are very welcome and have their place, but I would love to see that balanced with more Australian-led commercial product. That would be exciting to me, because we have some really exciting theatre makers in this country, and there is a bit of a gap in the ladder. You know, I think as an Australian creative, it's tricky to sort of get that experience of running a multi-million-dollar musical. You know, that's rare in this country.
Yeah.
And just more Australian stories told in Australian ways. I think I think we're getting there. And I think COVID is a really interesting time because lots of people are writing right now at home, writing and developing because nothing's being produced. But there is a lot of writing going on and a lot of development and ideas stirring. And it will be very interesting to see what stories and what appetite for what stories people have in a post-COVID world. What type of stories are audiences going to want to hear and see? And, you know, I think it is our job as storytellers to help process moments like this. It is our job to bear witness to it and process it. And so at the moment I'm trying to just sort of pay attention and listen and observe so that whenever we are creating next, it will be it can't not be affected by this process, by this experience. So it will be in the work whether or not we want it to be or not. It will be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, exactly.
Amazing.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That's okay.
So lovely chat.
Yeah.
Good chat
with you
guys forever.
Yeah. Yeah. It was great. So many pearls of wisdom that you have. Love hearing what you have to say. Yeah. It's great.
Oh, thanks, guys.
That was such a good conversation with Sean. It was so nice to hear his journey going into directing because I feel pressure even now, and I'm not even in the industry yet, that if I don't do the performing thing, then I'm a failure. And people saying, oh, those who can't do teach, like it's just crazy. And there's just so many things that we can venture into that are still part of our art, and it doesn't always have to be the performing part. And yeah, it was really nice to have a conversation about that.
I completely agree. I definitely don't think you just have to be a performer and that's the be all and end all. And I love that Sean has absolutely no ego and is such a generous human and decided to pour that generosity into his directing, and sharing his talents with artists like us.
Thank you so much to Sean.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us this week on Company. If you enjoyed this episode with Sean, please let us know on our Facebook or Instagram at Company Pod. We'd love to hear your thoughts. You can find Sean on his website, seanrenoir.com, and his Instagram at seanrenoir.
Big shout out to our producing guru, Douglas Rental, media queen, Deirdre Koo, also known as Deedledum Designs, and David Duquette on music. Catch you next time. Bye.